Well, in a moment, you're going to hear from Neil Adams, who has had one heck of an accomplishment in the comic book industry. And in a moment, you'll also find out that he's going to make mainstream science wake up because he has some incredible theories about the universe. All that and much more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Neil Adams is a towering figure in the world of comic book creation and art. He has had two legendary runs on the characters of Batman, X-Men, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and Deadman. He has always been and has repeatedly been forced to be a spokesperson on the subject of creators' rights and was influential in convincing comic book publishers to return artwork to the artists who create it. Adams, who the intervening years became one of the most talked about creative writer, artist, publisher, innovators in the medium and in the fields of computer animation as well. His theory on a new model of the universe is the subject of a forthcoming graphic novel and a two-hour video. And a bit later on, when you have a moment, go take a look at the animation he supplied us on the coasttocoastam.com website. And we'll also play a little clip from that video that he gave us, because those of you who may not have a computer. Our special guest tonight, Neil Adams. Neil, how are you?
Hello, George. How are you?
Good. God, I've been fascinated with your work for years, even though I didn't know exactly that it was you behind some of those things.
Well, you know, but for a long time, artists weren't able to sign their work. Things kind of have changed because there's certain revolutionaries who have gotten a little bit, well, insistent on the fact that artists ought to sign their names and ought to be able to be given credit for the work that they do. So one of the reasons you haven't seen it is because nobody put up the fight. And
well,
then
I understand.
After a while, people do.
I'm going to devote this program to talk about your theories of the universe, but I want to talk for about 10 minutes or so about your life in the comic book industry, which so many people just are fascinated with, and in your work. When you were young, Neil, I mean, did you doodle and do things like that? Were you a good artist as a kid?
Well, you know, there are an awful lot of people in the country who are who want to be comic book artists, who are kind of comic book artists. And people are always asking how they became this and how young did they start. The incredible thing is almost every one of them started as a small child. I know that I started when I was 6 years old, and I sat at my mother's kitchen table and I would draw old maid cards. And my mother would sit drinking her coffee, and she would look over and say, "That's good, honey." And every time my mom would say, "That's good, honey," I would do another drawing. And it's little things like this that, you know, make a career. I don't think my career was made by anything any more than my mom saying, "That's good, honey."
Did you ever submit the drawings to those magazines when they always had contests and say, "If you can sketch this Mickey Mouse, we'll give you a prize"?
Not really, but what I did do is I did that Draw Me contest, which really was just a come on to sell you an art course. And in fact, the salesman came by and sold me the art course, which I did for a while, but then I went to art school and then the whole thing changed. I did take it seriously. I did become, incredibly enough, a comic book artist, which at the time that it happened was actually impossible, because we had a thing in America called remember those days when they were against communists in our country?
Uh-huh.
Well, at exactly that same time, they were against comic books. There was a gentleman who wrote a book called The Seduction of the Innocent, which implied that any child that perhaps smashed a cop over the head or robbed a store who also read comic books was probably influenced by those comic books. This was in the 50s. And Congress had hearings against comic books, and publishers went to those hearings, and they were ostracized. And we in America really closed the door on comic books. So when I was very young and I was growing up, we had a campaign in America, just like we had a campaign against communists, and we had a campaign against comic books. And for a long time, comic books in America were not very popular. So when I decided to become a comic book artist, unfortunately for me, was that exactly that time in America when we had decided that comic books were a little better than toilet paper.
I wish I still had my old Batman and Superman comics. I was born in 1950, so you are right around, what, 10 years old, maybe 1960? I think that's when I really started getting into it.
Well, as time has gone by and America has begun to accept comic books until the point that they've become every second movie that we see, those old comic books, for those fans who kept them, have become very, very valuable. You can put your kids through college with your old comic book collection.
Oh, my God. I had hundreds of them, Neil.
I know. you and everybody else in America, you should hear the story from every second person that I meet at a comic book convention about how their mom threw their comic books away when they were away at school.
Yep, and they also tossed away my baseball cards and
that's
everything
right,
else.
That's right, your baseball cards. Incredible.
Well, how did you make the evolution to become a comic book illustrator?
Well, actually,
and creator.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And creator. No, go ahead.
I was interested in doing several things. I was interested in science, and I was interested in art. And unfortunately for me, things got very bad for my family, and I realized that I would not be able to go through college. And fortunately for me, I was a pretty good young artist. And so I did go to art school, and it was an art high school. I never got to go to college because my family couldn't afford it.
Right.
But I was able to make a living as soon as I got out of high school and did very well in spite of myself. I've always kept the desire to do science or be involved in science because, to me, very, very intellectually stimulating. Not very different from comics in a weird kind of way. And if you ask me about it, I'll tell you.
We'll get to that.
All right.
The comic books, the illustrator, the artist, is he also the writer of the copy that's in the comic book, or do they have someone else do that?
Sometimes he is and sometimes he isn't. But, you know, when doing a comic book is very much like making a movie. You have a writer, you have a director, you have actors, but, of course, our actors come out of the tips of our pencils. Doing comic books is very much like that. You have a writer who sits down and he writes a script. You have an artist who pencils. Very often you have an artist who inks. Very often you have an artist who letters. Very often you have a separate artist who colors. So it's like a production line. Some of the offbeat comic books are written and drawn by the same people, or some artists are also writers, and they'll do the job as a separate job. But each one of these things, just like in making a movie or a television show, are basically different jobs.
Have you seen an evolution in the characters that you've been associated with, the Batman, the X-Men, the Green Arrow? Have they changed both in look and content?
Well, I'll tell you a little story, George.
Okay.
When I was when I started at DC Comics, there was that television show. Remember the Batman television show more a satire than it was a television show? More than it was serious.
Mm-hmm.
Well, while I was at DC Comics, they were kind of following the television show. In other words, Batman had become kind of a funny character. He would walk in the daytime, and he would be talking to Commissioner Gordon, and people wouldn't go by and say, "Mommy, there's a man walking around in his underwear," because it was comedy. It was satire.
Mm-hmm.
So what would happen is that it sort of watered down the character. Even though the TV series was so very tremendously popular, the comic book sort of like took the brunt of it because, well, it was a comedy TV series. So when I was at DC, I asked the Batman editor, I said, his name is Julie Schwartz. He said, I said, "Julie, could I do Batman?" And Julie kicked me out of his office. So I came back a couple of times, and after a couple of times, I realized I got the hint that perhaps he didn't want me doing it. So I went down the hall to another editor who did a book called Brave and Bold, and that was a book that every month included Batman and other characters like Aquaman and Deadman and all these other characters. And I said, "Murray, I'd like to do this book." And he said, "Well, you know, that sounds okay. Sure." Now, he kind of loved me, so he let me do the book, and he let me do the book the way I wanted to. Well, of course, I wanted to do Batman as this dark Avenger, and these other characters as those characters. About 2 or 3 months later, the editor of Batman came down the hall waving a handful of letters from fans and yelling at me, saying, "Adams, what's going on here? Why are these letters saying that the only Batman at DC Comics is in Brave and the Bold and not in Batman?" I said, I don't know, Juliet. I just, you know. I said, "I'm really not doing him that much different." He said, "Yes, you are." Then he cornered me and he said, "Look, Adams, how come you think you know how Batman ought to be done and the rest of us don't?" And I said, "Julie, it's not that I know how Batman should be done. It's me and every kid in America knows how Batman ought to be done.
Good for you.
Just here in DC Comics, nobody seems to know how to do Batman." And from that day on, I mean, he hired me to do Batman, and we became very good friends. And that's how Batman has been done since that point on, as a dark Avenger, kind of serious character, but of course the Batman that we know and love.
Did comics sell in the millions during the early time period?
Well, it had transitional periods. Right at the beginning, comic books were, to put it mildly, boring. Right at the beginning, comic books were copies of comic strips. So you had comic books that were about detectives and about cowboys and funny cartoons and stuff like that. Basically, they were imitations of the comic strips. The publishers of comic books just wanted to make extra money, and they said, why don't we just reprint comic strips? And they ran out of their supply of reprints of comic strips, so they got teenagers to do these comic books that were imitations of the strips, which, again, were about detectives and cowboys. Then these two little Jewish kids in Cleveland, Ohio, who had this idea to do a superhero called Superman, did this character. Now, they had been doing comic books for a while. They had created Superman when they were 17 years old. And then they tried to sell it to the syndicates to try to make a comic strip out of it, and it got turned down. So Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman, came to New York after they had sold stuff after high school to the comic book publishers about detectives and cowboys. They brought their prized possession, Superman, to DC Comics. And they tried to get them to publish it. And DC Comics took a very casual attitude about it. They said, well, you boys, you know, you're doing good detective stories and cowboy stories for us. We'll run your Superman. They did. And that was the beginning of an era in America, the era of superheroes. Comic book newsstands, or newsstands, local newsstands, when they put Superman out on the rack, sold out within an hour.
My God.
They called the company and said, give us more of these Superman comic books. We can't keep them on the stands. Within a couple of months, they had million-seller comic books. They couldn't believe it. So what they did is they took all their artists and writers and said, you guys, draw these superhero things. I don't know what they are, but kids love them.
Yeah, keep them coming.
Within a year, you had Batman, Zatra the Magician, Wonder Woman, all these other superhero comic books, and then they sold in the millions.
I cannot remember how thick the comics were. How many pages were they, Neil?
64 pages for 10 cents, all in full color.
And what do they cost now?
Well, they start at $2.50, and they go up from there. It's very much like a book. I mean, you're really buying a book. When you call it a comic book now, you're serious about it. It's printed on good paper. It's got good color. It's got good reproduction. It's a regular-sized comic book, which is 24 pages, but you'll buy it for $3, $3.50.
And how often in the old days did the new editions come out? They come out every month?
They've never been known as anything but periodicals. I mean, the idea of calling comic books doesn't make any sense because they are, just like magazines, periodicals. There are no such thing as a comic book. In fact, the idea, the putting the two words are almost a joke because no comic books are hardly ever comical. And nor are they books. They're periodicals. They're magazines.
And in that era, you had to make every scene by hand, I guess, right?
Well, that's pretty much the way it is today.
Oh, still? Really?
Oh, yeah.
Computers don't take, or do you make them with computers?
Well, you can use computers, but, you know, computers are very, very much like a pencil. And that's how we think of them as artists. And they're very good pencils, but they are basically pencils. And they're a tool. And they mean nothing unless the creator. I mean, you know, you work on a computer to one degree or another, but it's basically your brain and the computer's multiple function. You can tell a computer to multiply for you, but you can't put the original figures down to tell the computer what it's multiplying. The computer just does the automatic task of multiplying. So a computer for an artist is very much like that. You tell an artist, you give a computer a stroke. And you say, okay, now all the lines in this drawing that I've just done are going to have this stroke on it, and then it has a certain style. But essentially, it's just a robot. It's computers. Let me put it this way: for artists, computers are stupid. If you just think of computers as stupid, but they do a tremendous amount of work. Tremendous amount of work. That's how they help artists. So they've become a boon to artists, not in any way taking away any creativity.
In your legendary career, and it has been, Neil, it has been. What's the one accomplishment that even you sit back and go, I did this? Is there anything there?
Well, there are a couple of things. Now, people are awful nice to me. You got to remember, you know, once you get to a certain point, folks are awful nice. I've had to kind of fight for the rights of creatives, because when we went through that time that I told you about, where that book was written, there was an awful lot of repression. Repression is followed by a lack of rights. It just seems to happen that way. When things get bad, your rights get taken away. I don't know why that is. And that happened in this industry. So when I came into the industry, it was like coming into the dark ages of comic books. I had been out in the real world. I had done advertising, and I even had a syndicated comic strip. I was doing very well. I came into comic books, and I was shocked to discover that they did things like, well, they would cut up the originals for the artists and throw them away after 3 months. There were no royalties in the comic book business for anybody. For anybody. You could sell a million copies. You had no royalties. And the worst thing that happened was that the creators of Superman had disappeared.
What do you mean they disappeared? Where'd they go?
They just disappeared. I had no idea. No matter who I would ask and what I would say, people would say, shh, we don't talk about Jerry and Joe. I was stunned. I mean, obviously somebody knew something about them, but they had basically gone. But they were essentially the creators of an industry. Then, I forget when it was, 1970-something. 76, something like that. I got a letter, and I had become, because I had, in the intervening years, I had gone to sort of fight with the companies about the return of original art and royalties, sure, and stuff like that. And I had become a little bit rowdy, and as time went by, in a friendly way, positive, friendly way. You know, this is a good idea to give the artists back their pages because, you know, in the end, they'll be able to sell their page to collectors. They'll be able to make more money. They'll, yep, put more work into their originals. You will benefit by it, Mr. Publisher, because they will be very interested in having good work out there, and you'll publish it and you'll make more money. And if you give them royalties, a very similar thing will happen. They'll do good work, see, for you, and you'll make more money. Little arguments like that I would have. And, of course, in the end, I won.
Good for you. Good for you.
But I discovered what happened was I got this long letter from Jerry Siegel, the writer of Superman.
He appeared somewhere.
Yeah, in a letter. And he had written a letter to a number of news media. And in the news media, he described their plight. He and his partner, Joe, were just approaching 60 years old. And for the last 15 years, they had voluntarily disappeared because their lawyers had told them they could retrieve the rights to their character, Superman. And they could go to court because the copyright law was written after 35 years. You get, I forget exactly what it was, certain rights. You can get those rights back. You could even go to the Supreme Court and get those rights back. And they were promised by their lawyers that, in fact, that was what was going to happen. And on their 60th year, as they were approaching their 60th year, they made a big effort to get in touch with their lawyers, who seemed to have disappeared. Not disappeared, just not answer the phone.
Exactly.
And here they were, 60 years old. They had been silent for 15 years. Jerry Siegel was working as a clerk for $7,500 a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Joe Shuster, who was legally blind, was living in the apartment in Queens of his brother, who was, and he basically couldn't work anymore. He in fact, had worked, I discovered later, as a messenger, the creator of Superman, as a messenger. He lived in his brother's apartment. He slept on a cot next to a window that had cracks in it and was taped up. I have photographs of his room, creator of Superman. And now they were trying to say, well, we can't get in touch with our lawyers and we don't know what to do because...
Finish that story when we come right,
sure,
back, Neil. We've got to take this break and then we'll talk about this incredible theory, his new model of the universe. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Neil Adams, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Neil's website is linked up right there at coasttocoastam.com, but it's Neil, N-E-A-L, Adams, A-D-A-M-S.com. Go take a look at some of the things he has up on his website, and we'll be back. We'll let him finish his story about the creators of Superman, whatever happened there, and then we'll get into his model of the universe on Coast to Coast AM. So the creators of Superman get a hold of you. They send you a letter. Now they're looking for their attorneys, and they just can't find them, can they?
They just can't find them, and in fact, their rights in that particular instance had run out. They were 60-year-old men that they didn't have you know, a pot to, and you know what I mean.
Yes, I do.
He didn't. There was no place to turn. So they got some newspaper articles, and I realized the newspaper articles was going to run out. And I gave him a call, and I said, look, you know, fellas, I'd like to represent you. Not as a lawyer. I'd just like to represent you in the media, because you know something about the media is you really can go to the media and say, look, there's a really big problem here, and folks will listen. And so they said, you know, we really appreciate it, and we sort of made a little quick agreement that I would do that, and they'd let me do it. Which, of course, you have to get that permission. For about 4 months, we had a little tussle back and forth. You know, chicken feathers were flying. But in the end, the people who had inherited or purchased DC Comics agreed that the creators of Superman ought to be taken care of. In the meantime, during that time, we went on the old Tomorrow Show, Howard Cosell show. We had a lot of television shows. We were in touch with a lot of reporters. But in the end, you know, sometimes you just have to shine a light on something. And people realize that it's wrong, and they do something about it. And that's pretty much what happened. My blood pressure went up a little bit, but back down after.
Are they still alive, Neil?
They're not. No, they've since died, but their families are taken care of. They were taken care of for the last 15 years of their lives. They got to go to the premieres of the movies that were about their characters. They received the good income and health insurance and all the rest of it, and they were taken care of. So
good for you.
I think we got a gold star in our notebook on that one.
Absolutely.
So if you're asking me what one of the things that I'm most proud of, I think that's about it.
Well, that tells me a lot about you.
It really
does. So how does this tremendous artist, this creator of people's imagination, get so involved in science to do what you're doing today, and that is working on models of these? Which
well,
I got to tell
pretty
you,
funny. I don't know about you. I think it's pretty crazy.
I got to tell you though, through the eyes of an animator and a creator like you are, after looking at the animation that you sent us, and with your permission, in a minute, I'd like to run the Earth portion audio, if that's okay.
Sure.
I've got to tell you, you have seen a picture that nobody has really looked at before.
Well, actually, some people along the way have. There's a in the about 40 years ago, scientists did the same thing that any kid that's 10 years old would do. They'd look at the globe of the world and they'd say, "Gee, you know, it looks like Africa kind of fits together with South America there." And scientists did that same thing. They finally realized that that was true, and they said, "Well, maybe they did fit together." And so they came up with this theory that explained that. And the theory was based on an awful lot of science. And the science said, well, you know, with tectonic matching, we can show that these levels of these continents actually fit together. And if we go back in history, we can show that, let's say, an Allosaurus or a different dinosaur lived on all seven continents of the Earth all at the same time. And that plants that are in Europe are exactly the same as the plants that are in North America. So we can make all these connections, so it must mean that these continents were together. And so they announced that, in fact, they were together. And so what they said was that all the continents were on one big giant island on one side of the Earth. Now, the continents of the Earth cover about one quarter of the Earth. So basically they were saying that a continent the size of one quarter of the Earth covered one side of the Earth. Now, I'd studied science since I was a little kid. I love science. I love science the way another person might love comic books. And I realized, and I'd studied tectonics and all the rest of it, and I realized, you know, they were right. By golly, it certainly looked like all the continents were together, and because we had all this mixing of all these plants, all these flora and fauna. But I thought, you know, this is an awfully weird picture. You know, I'm imagining myself jinking across space in my little spaceship and approaching this planet, and I see this planet out there, and it's got one big giant island on one side of the Earth, and I fly around the planet with my little spaceship, and the rest of it is ocean 5 miles deep.
All over the place.
All over. That's three quarters of the Earth, and one quarter is this one big, I don't know, iris on the eyeball of this planet. And I think, that is the weirdest picture I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I can understand that the continents were together. Heaven only knows, they certainly were. But on one side of the Earth, didn't make any sense. I couldn't even imagine, had the Lord come down and just jammed all these continents together on one side, had nature fixed it so this would happen? Because when I looked at moons and I looked at Mars, everything was kind of fairly evenly distributed. It was a little lumpy in places. You know, Mars has little dark areas. But to bring them all together like that didn't make any sense to me. And I thought, you know, Has anybody gone and matched the Pacific, the tectonics in the Pacific, to see if they fit together as well? I mean, it seems like, you know, we're being very Western, you know, North American, European, you know, all the continents in the Atlantic came together. What about the Pacific? Do we measure the tectonics in the Pacific? Seemed like the idea was, since we had already measured them in the Atlantic, and of course the world couldn't have grown, then there was a waste of time to measure them in the Pacific, so no reason to do that.
And the difference in size between the space,
right?
is tremendous, isn't
fantastic,
it?
Fantastic, you know. But I thought, you know, I sit and I go out to New York Pier and I look out over the ocean and I think, you know, that's a big space going all the way over to Europe like that. Why is it that we're only looking at that space, and why aren't we saying, well, this space, if it moved a little faster, could just be a little bit bigger, and it would be harder to recognize. Maybe we wouldn't have to be 10-year-old kids and the thing would be so obvious to us. But if we would sit and figure it out, we would discover that the Pacific came together as well. Well, didn't seem like anybody was interested in doing that. They had this great theory. They knew that all the continents fit together, so why did they have to go any further? Well, anyway, it's long, you know, in those 40 years ago, I heard that this geologist, and I didn't know his name at the time, it turns out to be a guy named Samuel Warren Carey from Australia, presented the idea that, you know, it makes way more sense that the Earth was smaller 200 million years ago, and that all the islands, all the continents did fit together, but they fit on a smaller Earth. Well, that shook everybody up. Everybody got all upset by that.
I think that would. Yeah.
But I'm sitting behind my drawing board going, well, this makes all the sense in the world to me, because I don't, this other thing is ridiculous. You got pieces of land sliding around the ocean as if they're floating on the water. You know, I imagine these little Warner Brothers ants kind of chugging along, pulling these continents.
And holding them up.
And, you know, carrying them over their heads like picnic baskets and moving them around and crashing them into one another. This fella seemed to make a whole lot more sense. He said, well, what if the Earth grew? What if the continents or those pieces of land just broke apart and they stayed where they are and they just kind of grew outward as the Earth grew? There might be some irregularities, but essentially that makes a whole lot more sense geologically. Well, the scientific community didn't like that. They didn't think that, you know, it's one thing to say that continents move around. It's another thing to say that the Earth grew.
And when we talk about grew, what size do you think he had in mind when he said it was smaller?
Well, let's put it to the test. If you have a sauropod, let's say sauropods are those things that we used to call Brontosauruses.
Yeah.
And it weighs, oh, 4 to 5 times the size of, let's say, an elephant, which is the biggest land animal that we have that can actually walk and not run. Elephants really can't take their feet off the ground very much. If you compare that in size and you say, well, it's 4 times the size, oh, some of them even 5 times the size, and in general, dinosaurs were about 4 times the size of the animals that we have today, then that could easily say that the Earth could actually be as much as one quarter, only one quarter the size that it is today, and the dinosaurs would make sense.
Maybe about the size as the moon is now.
No. So actually, it would be a little bit closer to a slightly larger Mars.
All right.
So it would have to be like Mars. So a dinosaur would weigh one quarter what it weighs today, something in that range, if you want to just do a rough estimate. Now, that would not necessarily mean that the gravity would be one quarter. It might be one third, because you'd have, you know, the middle of the Earth would be more dense, and now it would be a little bit more open, perhaps. So you're in that range, one quarter to one third. So then you kind of look at it and go, well, if that's the way it was, then I can take the Earth back, and I can put those continents together, and dinosaurs would make sense. And, you know, the fact that there were hardly any mountains on Earth, that would make a certain amount of sense, because that would mean that the crust were thinner. And, you know, it actually fits the geology. Funny. Odd. And so I thought, as a science buff at the time, this guy, whoever this guy is, he knows what he's talking about. Well, they decided, no, that wasn't the way it was going to be. They sensibly decided, because, you know, it was a little bit much to think that the Earth could have grown. After all, the Earth has been here for 5 billion years.
Yeah.
I mean, how could it be that size now?
Oh, and then you got to come up with a theory, how does it grow?
Yes, and that was the big problem. Basically, they said to whoever it was, and of course I didn't know at the time that it was Sam Carey, they said, how can you explain how the Earth could grow? And he didn't have an answer. Now, he couldn't exactly have an answer because he was a geologist. He wasn't a physicist, and he wasn't a cosmologist. So the likelihood that he would have an answer as to how the Earth could grow, even a theory, would be pretty extreme because he was a geologist, a very good geologist, but still a geologist. And it's one of the things that have bothered me in the comic book business and medicine, all kinds of areas of expertise, and that is that scientists seem to specialize these days. There's no, like, general scientist that knows everything. They just know their specialty. So Sam Carey knew geology. Geologically, he was totally correct. But he couldn't explain how the Earth could grow because he had no theory to explain it. Yeah. Later on, he tried to do it, but it was really too late. He had pretty much thrown his career in the stove and turned on the flame. It was pretty much it for him.
Not Which happens... It happens to great minds, doesn't it sometimes? Yeah.
He redeemed his theory, his career, but essentially he never redeemed the theory. The good guys had won. We discovered that the Earth had stayed the same size all this time, and Mr. Carey had gone back to Australia. Now, of course, I'm sitting there behind my drawing board going, I can see this in my mind. I can see how the continents come together. He clearly has the right idea. Everything in the history of science makes this make sense. There were no real mountains in those days. There must have been a thinner crust. There were no, in fact, oceans. Listen to this one, this will really knock you out. The scientists, if you ask a scientist, or back in those days, you ask a scientist, where do you get ancient fish fossils from? He'll say, well, we get them from Utah. We get them from Italy, and we get them from China. You say, well, don't you get them from the deep ocean? They say, no, there are no ancient fish fossils down in the ocean. So you say, well, that's not possible. The oceans
there's got to be
down there, you know. And they say, no, we get them in Utah. Really? Well, we had shallow seas on the continents, you see, and those shallow seas were all these ancient fish. And you say, well, what about the oceans? So, well, no, we don't. They're not down there. So what they did was the scientists and the Navy, they went around and they took core samples of the bottom of the ocean to see how old it was, because you could do that. You know, you send a core sample, pull it up, and you can measure how old the bottom of the sea was. Well, in the first 10 years that they did this, they couldn't find any part of the ocean that was any older than 70 million years old. Next 10 years, they actually found some areas that were older than that, and they took some areas off the coast of North America and off the coast of Asia that were as old as, they say, 180 million years old. Now, 180 million years old sounds like a long time, but geologically it's really not.
It's nothing when we're 4.5 billion years old.
And certainly since life started 2 billion years ago, and robust dinosauric life, or at least reptile life, started 600 million years old, 180 million years old is not very old at all. So they couldn't find one place in the ocean that was older than 180 million years old. And in fact, a majority of the ocean is less old than the time that the dinosaurs died. Half the ocean didn't exist on the day that the last dinosaur died.
Where'd all this water come from, Neil?
Yeah, well, the water. If you have a growing Earth, I don't ask anybody to accept this theory.
I got to tell you, I love this theory.
All right. Let me throw it out because I don't want to convince anybody. I just want to just talk about it, you know, because it's a little hard after a while to get. If you have a planet that's making stuff, okay, let's say you found a theory, and of course that's the problem. If you have a planet that's making stuff, you have to find out where it's going to make it. So the logical place is in the core, because it certainly doesn't make it at my aunt's house.
Sure.
So it makes it in the core. And as it makes it, it makes all the minerals and all the other things, because it's got to make the atoms sort of the way they are in the elementary scale. You know, it's got to make everything. And as it makes everything, it makes gases, which include oxygen and hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And any time it makes gases, of course, those gases tend to rise, and they will rise up through the rock of the Earth, and they will rise to the surface, and they will come out of, let's say, vents in the middle of the ocean, or geysers like Yosemite, or volcanoes, you know, where you get lots of rocks, but essentially you get gas.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost like people don't notice it, but you know that stuff that rises out of those volcanoes, that's called gas. And there's lots of gas in there. There's hydrogen, there's oxygen, there's carbon, carbon dioxide. There's lots of stuff there. And all that stuff goes into the atmosphere and makes your atmosphere. And when the oxygen and the hydrogen get together, they make water and they make clouds and they fall onto the Earth. So if your planet is growing, then you're making exactly the same amounts of all those gases, only increasingly as time goes by, so that the water that you had on the land, as it cracks, as the Earth cracks open and rifts open and spreads, and those big ocean basins open up, the water will drain off the land and into those new cracks, and they will form the new oceans, just like they did when that land was on a smaller Earth, and they had smaller cracks, and they would crack open, and you'd get the Grand Canyon and places like that, and they would drain into those areas. Like, if you go out to Arizona, for example, one of the things that people don't exactly see with their eyes is sometimes you kind of need to be an artist to do it. You see what you call tableland. You know, you get this flat land, and then it comes to this ridge, and it goes straight down like a plummet.
Yep.
And then it goes down to the bottom, and then you get this flat land again. And if you were to look at that and analyze it, you'd say, well, you know what it looks like? It looks like if I go all the way over there on the right, I'll find another one of those things going back up again, and it'll flatten out over on the top. And if I take those two pieces of land and I pull them together, that will close up, and I will have filled in that space. So logically, if I go back in time, what happened was that land cracked apart, you know, made that flat edge and that flat edge on the other side, and those areas pulled apart and made this flat land on the bottom. Well, if you were to take all the water out of the oceans, that's exactly what the oceans look like. You go out on the continental shelf, you go out on the beach, and you go out into the ocean, you go out and it slants down for a while. Then it comes to a certain point, it goes straight down for 2 to 3 to 4 miles, straight down like a plummet. Then it slides out across the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, and it goes to the other coast, and it goes straight up, and then it goes slanted up into your land. That's exactly what the ocean looks like. It looks like Arizona, only bigger. Now, if you look at that as the way the Earth grows, or any planet grows, that thing, when you see that, and you get that image in your mind, and you see that flat land goes straight down and goes across the bottom land and then goes back up on the other side, you've seen land that splits open wherever you see it. And we see it as human beings all the time, everywhere. We just don't know it for what it is.
I just had a story yesterday of some geologists in Ethiopia who witnessed the Earth splitting, and they say it's the birth of an ocean that's going to cut through the Horn of Africa.
Well, think about this. If land splits open, where does that land go? It's got to go somewhere.
It's got to go somewhere.
Well, if you have a ball that's only a certain size, it's got to go somewhere.
You spread it out.
You keep cracking open and spreading and spreading and spreading. Our oceans cover 3/4 of the Earth. Every ocean on Earth has that flat tableland from the continent, drops down to from between 2 and 4 miles, flattens out across the ocean, and goes back up again. That's pull apart. Call it pull apart. And that's all our oceans. That's 3/4 of the Earth. And down there, that ocean, nowhere, not one square yard of that ocean bottom is older than 180 million years old.
That's incredible.
It is incredible if you think about it. It's preposterous. It's like a big joke. Big joke is, where'd it come from? And scientists have run away from that dramatically so much. And I'm not saying they did it wrong. I mean, you know, they look for reasons and they've come up with theories, and those theories are the theories that we sort of believe now. But when you look at it, it's incredible.
And I've always said to myself, all the water on this planet didn't come from ice balls and comets. There's no way. If we got hit with those many objects, this planet would have been torn apart. We'll be back in a moment. Neil Adams, our guest. I'm going to play some audio that comes along with his animation on planet Earth. He has supplied us with 4 different kinds of animation. If you want to get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, we'll be back in a moment. And with our special guest tonight, Neil Adams. Neil, now the theory of Pangaea, of course, shows exactly, as you have illustrated, how these land masses split apart. But it doesn't talk about the possibility that the planet was much smaller at the time.
Right.
Do you believe your theory, based on what you've heard, because of the fact that it's hard to believe that all that land mass was in one small area?
Well, before I answer Perhaps just let me warn anybody who's sending me an email right now that says I should know that a duck-billed platypus is a monotreme and not a marsupial. I know it's a monotreme. It's a little edit thing there. Yes, a duck-billed platypus is a monotreme. Don't send me the email. But yeah, got it. Okay. But yeah, of course it was shocking to me. I mean, the concept to imagine that all the continents, you know, you could push them together and they would all match and it would be on this planet that would be, well, of course, if you count the continental plane, it wouldn't be quite one quarter the size, but essentially very, very small, about the size of Mars. Shocking. Shocking. But when you add it to all the other facts, the size of the dinosaurs, the thinness of the atmosphere, the lack of a thick crust that would make that mountains, after all, people don't quite realize that the Rocky Mountains are only about 30 million years old. They don't realize that the Himalayas are only about 40 million years old. They think that they were there for, you know,
since the inception of the planet. Yeah.
Yeah, not true. It's all new stuff. The Earth, essentially, if you go by this theory, and please, I'm not asking anybody to accept this theory. It's just a discussion. Don't jump on me and say I'm trying to change everything. But if you think about it, if the Earth grew, logically, it would have grown as a process, and it would have happened exponentially. It would have happened increasingly. It would have started out quite small, and then it would have grown very, very slowly for a long period of time. And then as time went by and as the energy increased, then it would have grown more quickly. And it kind of explains, if that's the case, why the last 60 million years were much faster growing than the previous 60 million years. So it's a kind of a progression thing. And there are proofs all over the place, except that people don't look for them. For example, you know, you have Enceladus. You've been talking about Enceladus lately, mm-hmm. That moon of Saturn.
That has gushing water now.
Yes, it has gushing water. Now, people think of it a certain way. And of course, I think of it from a slightly different point of view. I've been dealing with photos of Enceladus for a while. And if you look at the photos, you'll notice that there are cracks, if you look at especially the close-ups. You look at these cracks. Now, if you were to get down on the ground, it'd look like Arizona. You know, you get these big cracks and rifts that run up the planet.
That's right.
So if you were to take a pair of scissors and you were to cut one of those photos right up the cracks and slide those cracks together, essentially you'd be making Enceladus a little bit smaller. You'd keep on sliding those cracks together. After a while, you'd have a smaller planet. And you'd notice that if you look at different parts of the planet, there's lots of cracks under the land that seem to have pulled apart. Now, if you consider that for just a minute, and then you consider the fact that it's like nature has gone and squeezed this lemon and is spraying all this water out into space, shouldn't that mean that Enceladus is getting smaller? I mean, how long has that water been spraying out into space? We look at it now and we say, well, okay, so maybe it's, I don't know, a gallon a second or whatever the amount is.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
A pitcher an hour. Whatever that is, then you have to ask yourself, how long has this been going on? Let's say, 100 million years?
All right.
5 million years? Pick a number. However long it's been going on, you have to multiply what you see now by whatever that time is. That means that there's a whole lot of water inside that moon being sprayed out over time. Why isn't it shrinking? Is there a big hole inside? In other words, if you take a water gun and you spray that water gun, after a while, that water gun's going to be empty, and then you're going to have a big old empty water gun. Well, I don't know why people aren't quite thinking about it that way, but if I were to look at Enceladus, I would say, well, if all this water is spraying out, who's making it? Where's it coming from? And where's the big hole that it's emptying? Because it must be there, or else Enceladus is making that water.
Just like the planet Earth did, based on your thoughts.
I'm not saying that it's true. I'm simply saying from a logical point of view, if you look at it and you see the water spraying out, there's got to be some empty space that's coming from, because my water gun would run out a long time ago.
But you know, it makes you think, and it could be true, because some of the other explanations don't make sense. I just said right before the break, I don't believe that our oceans got filled up by comets bringing in water balls.
It really doesn't.
Ice balls. I don't believe it.
Now, the problem is that we've had a history. In the history, about 150 years ago, there were these thinkers. Some of them were scientists, but some of them were thinkers. And, you know, we got out of this idea that the sun was traveling around the Earth and all these very wrong-thinking type of things. And we realized that space was very big. About 150 years ago, thinkers said to us, well, this is how it all worked. What happened was that there was all this stuff gathered in one area of space, chunks and meteorites and all kinds of things. And along comes gravity, a late arrival, galloping up on his horse, and he starts spinning all this stuff together, and it all collects into a sun and all these planets. And that's how our solar system was made. Now, we have that same kind, oddly enough, we have that same kind of thinking going on today. That's pretty much what we teach in school. That's the kind of thinking that's been going on for 150 years.
Yeah,
and I say, excuse me, there must be a Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster who created Superman, and it must be somewhere, because it doesn't make sense that they disappeared. Well, it doesn't make sense to me that there was a whole lot of stuff waiting around to be turned into a solar system. It just doesn't make sense. And if you go back and you look at meteorites, there's only one kind of meteorite that falls to Earth now that existed 4.5 billion years ago. And it's not the kind of meteorite that really gets made on a planet. Most of the meteorites that you get that fall from space, not most, but the ones that are made of silicate or made of iron, you can't get them that are 4.5 million years old. You only get a particular type of meteorite. It's called a chalandrite. And it seems to me that when you look at those, if you start taking clues from different parts of science and you construct a new picture, the new picture that you construct is different from the picture that we were told 150 years ago. For example, you have Jupiter. Jupiter, you know those meteorites that crashed on Jupiter and made those big explosions on Jupiter, the Shoemaker-Levy?
It's the comet, yeah.
Yeah, the Shoemaker-Levy things. Each one of those, there were 21 of them, they were all clustered together in one big ball. Each one of those is a planet killer. If one of them, one out of the 21, had hit the Earth, all life on Earth would be destroyed.
Yep. In an instant, almost.
In an instant. So what that does is it makes Jupiter into a kind of a meteorite umbrella. It seems to gather in all the big ones. If they get to a certain size, they seem to be gathered toward Jupiter. Otherwise, in our lifetime, it's impossible to believe that 21 of those planet killers could have hit Jupiter. Doesn't make any sense. And probably others will crash into Jupiter and we'll see them. It can't be that, I mean, I'm like Sherlock Holmes. I don't believe in coincidence. It doesn't make sense. It suddenly, we're looking up in space and 21 of these things crash into Jupiter and none of them crash into Earth. Never did. Never
will. Or even get close.
So what that means is that the likelihood is that Jupiter has grown big enough now to become our planetary umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
And that 600 million years ago, it wasn't so big. In fact, probably not so big at all.
That's true.
That's why when we look at the surface of Mars, we see what scientists call the old surface. And on the old surface, we see these big meteorite craters. And when we see the new surface, all we see are these little small meteorite craters. Same thing on Moon. If you look at the Moon, you see in certain areas, you see the old surface, which has these big meteorite craters. And then you see these things that are called mares, which people think is lava flow. I really don't think so.
Very smooth looking.
Very
right?
smooth. And if there are meteor craters, they're small. That essentially means that Jupiter has grown big enough. Now, we could say, well, there's no more big meteorites, but then there's Shoemaker-Levy, 21, hit Jupiter. I mean, you can make that argument, but the argument doesn't hold up. They hit Jupiter. Each one of them would have killed the Earth. Every one of those 21 would have killed the Earth. Jupiter is collecting them. That means that in our area of space, Jupiter has grown big enough to protect Mars and Earth from those big giant meteorites. Or the facts are not correct. Now, if you look at that, and then you put it together with the size of the dinosaurs, and then you put it together with the oceans, and you put it together with lots of other facts from other sciences, and this is sort of what I've been doing for the last 30 years. I've studied all the sciences. I said to myself way back when those guys were sent back, those geologists were sent back in shame to Australia, I said to myself, you know, I just like to duck the flak here. I don't think I want to put my hand up and get it shot off by everybody who's saying that you can't prove that the Earth grew. I think I just want to draw my comic books and hide. And I'm going to study science. I'm going to study paleontology. I'm going to study physics. I'm going to study cosmology. And I'm going to figure out how come it's possible that a planet could grow. In other words, for a planet to grow, you'd have to be able to make matter. And you can't do that, of course. Right?
Well,
it's funny about that.
I think the planet's alive, Neil.
Well, listen to this one. Listen to this one. There's a guy named Carl David Anderson, youngest man on Earth to win the Nobel Prize. 1932, he was observing cosmic rays. We've actually seen films of this in school, and we use this technology. He's watching cosmic rays, and the way he does it is he empties this big space of air, makes a vacuum. Then he puts in certain trace elements of noble gases. These are the gases that have, you know, like argon and neon, gases that have the outer shell of their atom has 8 complete electrons. And what happens is if a cosmic ray goes through this very thin gas, it'll kind of disturb the gas and make a glowing trail. So in 1932, here's Carl David Anderson watching these glowing trails in what amounts to a vacuum, saying, my God, those are cosmic rays. Now, we've seen films on this, and this is a fact. This is nothing strange here. What happened is, somewhere along the line, seems like one of those cosmic rays hits something, bounces off to the side, and it creates a piece of matter. And that piece of matter goes off and finds an electron and annihilates it. That piece of matter is called a positron. And now, a positron is the opposite of an electron. Electron is those things that are on the outside of all atoms. Positron is the opposite of that. Positron is a positive electron. It exists long enough to find an electron and annihilate the electron. But it came from nowhere. A second ago, it didn't exist. It just spontaneously is created by the cosmic ray hitting something invisible and bringing it into existence. Not because I say so. I have nothing to do with this. I'm just reading the books. A couple of years later, other scientists watching the same experiment discover that when that positron is created, an electron is created at exactly the same time, and they go off at right angles to one another. Out of nothing, you get a positron and an electron. The positron finds another electron, annihilates it, so they both disappear, and now you have a new electron. Everything's okay. Everything is balanced. Einstein is right. Newton is right. Everybody's right. But if you look at it honestly, you say, gee, it looks like that matter was created out of nothing because there was nothing there to begin with, and suddenly these two things were created, and one of them makes most of all of our atoms, electrons.
Does that tell you the planet is still growing, Neil?
Well, to me it says that if Sam Carey were a physicist, then he could go back and sit with his physicist friends and say, hey, let's talk about how matter can be created. And if somebody were to say it can't be created, they'd have to say, well, it can be created here. You can create an electron and a positron out of nothing. Now, wouldn't it be interesting if you could take that positron and you could put it through a process and turn it into a proton? Because if you could do that, you could take that electron, and you could take that positron, turn it into a proton, and you would make hydrogen. And if you could make hydrogen, you could make a universe.
So true.
Now, if that's happening, if a process like that or similar to that is happening inside the Earth, inside the Sun, inside all the planets, then what we have, now I don't want to get anybody excited here, but what we have is we have a growing universe, which means that there was no Big Bang.
Why is it getting
me in trouble here? See?
Well, no, not necessarily.
You went and got me in trouble.
Because I have always had a difficult time believing in the Big Bang theory. Now, scientists...
Well, I don't like to laugh out loud, but I agree with you. I think it's a preposterous theory. And it doesn't explain anything. Think about it. Universe exploded, it goes back. It exploded, it goes back. It exploded, it goes... That's just a process. What we want to know is, where did the universe come from in the first place?
Exactly.
In other words, if you believe that it always existed and all the matter that existed here always existed, it always will exist, that's one theory. If you think that you had a universe where you had, let's call it pre-matter, something, okay, what they used to call ether, mm-hmm. and you could make a piece of matter out of it with energy, and then you could make another and another and another until you had the universe that you had today, the question you'd have to ask is, who turned off the off switch? It makes sense that if the universe was created, then it's still being created.
Well, I'm also concerned about who turned it on.
Well, you know, I think everybody's concerned about that, but, you know, I don't know. And I don't pretend to know.
When we come back, can I chat with you about the possibility of multiple universes? I want to get your thought on that.
Oh, but you can, you know, but in all honesty, I have no idea.
I know, but you know what? Nobody does. Stay with us. Back in a moment. And we're talking with Neal Adams, legendary comic creator, and also, I can't call you a scientist, Neal.
No,
but
you can't do that.
You can't do that.
Can't
just
do that.
Some guy
maybe
with the
maybe
ability
an
to
theorize. Scientist.
Maybe
those,
so.
One of those people that studies everything.
Did the moon grow as well, you
sure.
think?
Everything would have to grow. I mean, the problem with a theory like this is if it works for one, it has to work for the other. You can't just say that the Earth grew. It's another problem that Carey had. You know, he said the Earth grew. But that leads to, by logical extension, to the idea that everything grows. And you must have a theory that explains how everything can grow. And you can't back off of it, or else you can't say that the Earth can grow. And without having a theory, without having a concept, even a concept, you can't say it. And I don't say it. I simply say there's, you know, my mom told me to think in terms of percentages. There's a percentage of things that can be possible, and there's a percentage of this. And what you do is you look for a better percentage. That's what I've been doing for 30 years. I've been studying all these sciences and studying these things that you see. For example, one of the videos that you have there is of the moon. And they have what they call mares on the moon. They're basically these big spread areas. And you know that one side of the moon faces the Earth, and one side of the moon faces away from the Earth all the time.
Yep.
That's the way it is. Pretty incredible when you think about it. There has to be a reason. And the reason has to fit into a theory. So there are scientists who used to believe, or some of them even still do believe, that those used to be, those mares, those big spread areas, were volcanoes. The logic is that if they were volcanoes, they'd be on the other side of the moon, too. Now, when I investigated these things from the point of view of this theory, I realized that what those things were pretty much the same things as we have with the oceans. They're big spread areas. In other words, something is created inside of the moon, comes to the surface, spreads the surface, and pushes the edges out, just like on the Earth, or on Enceladus, or on Ganymede, or any other moon and any other planet that's a solid rocky planet. So if that's true, if what I say is true, then what you have are these big spread areas, like sort of on a geode. You know what a geode is? Geode is you dig it up from the Earth, and it's like a rock. It's round. You cut it in half, and inside are crystals,
Okay. Beautiful
purple and different color crystals. And you kind of look at it and go, how did that get made? That's incredible.
Yeah.
Looks like it grew like a plant. Well, think of the moon like that. It grows from the inside. If that happens, then you get these spread areas. And I realized, looking at the moon, wow, you know, our moon has these incredibly big spread areas. I can make Jackie Gleason's face out of that. And I looked at these spread areas and I thought, that's what's going on here. That it's the surface is growing and spreading out like our oceans and pushing the edges aside. And then I realized, you know, what's interesting about our moon, different from all other moons, is that it doesn't spin the same way. That is, since it faces the Earth, the logic is that if something is growing from the inside, then the attraction of the Earth would cause that growth to be happening toward the Earth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The gravity of the Earth would be pulling on it.
Pull it right on.
So if there's growth going on, which would be a subtle kind of thing, matter is being made and pushing toward the surface, it would grow toward the Earth. So logically, there would be more of these mirrors facing the Earth than facing the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, of course, I sweated that one because I could blow my theory out of the water with that one. Because if there are mirrors on the other side of the moon, that means that what I'm saying doesn't make any sense. So I let myself sweat for about a week on that one before I got photos. Of course, we do have photos of the other side of the moon.
That's right.
Turns out there are no mirrors on the other side of the moon.
And your theory lives again.
It lived for one more week. Waiting to be shot down by logical and sensible people.
Well, what do you think? Yeah, but nobody's been able to do that yet.
You know, it's true. It's true.
What do you think the universe looked like if you take out the Big Bang theory?
Okay. I'll give you a sense of it if I can. Essentially, what you have to do is let's say you start simple. You have to start simple. It makes all the sense in the world that you start simple. I know this. In a way, I'm saying something that's so obvious that it's very hard to argue with, but still, you know, scientists love to have complication. But I say, well, why don't we, for the sake of it, we'll talk simple. Let's just say you can take, oh, cosmic rays, and you can hit this pre-matter stuff, and you can turn it into positrons and electrons, and you can go through a process to turn those positrons into protons. Sounds hard, but of course you're in a very, very early universe. What you can make is hydrogen. That's all you can make, because all you have are electrons and protons. You don't have neutrons. Very, very difficult to get neutrons, because we don't know how neutrons are made. We've seen electrons be made, and we've seen positrons be made. We don't know how protons are made, neutrons, but electrons we got. So let's just say we take this theory and we've got protons and neutrons. Whole universe filled with them, because after a while, keep on making them, you know, it gets pretty boring after all. You fill the whole universe up with them. Some kind of energy causes these hydrogen atoms to gather, because, of course, they're not going to gather because they tend to be kind of anti-gravitational. They don't like to go near one another. So maybe you have some kind of force that brings them together. We'll call that spin, because it does seem like our universe has a spin on it. Certainly all the galaxies have spins, and all the solar systems have spins. So you kind of, well, okay, I'll presuppose spin. And so you have spin, and you start spinning this stuff together, and after a while you get these bumps in this spin, you know, like in whirlpools. You have these little whirlpools within whirlpools. So what you get are suns. You don't get planets, and you don't get rocks, and you don't get moons. All you get are suns. So now you've got these suns. Now we've gone from nothing to hydrogen to suns, hydrogen suns. The thing about hydrogen is if you put enough hydrogen in one place and you make a sun out of it and you heat it up really good, it starts to go through a process where it makes helium. It makes helium by making neutrons. I realize I'm getting boring here, but you make neutrons, you can make helium. Now you've got a hydrogen sun that's got helium and hydrogen, but you don't have anything else. You don't have a solar system. So what you do is you heat up that sun, let it get bigger, let it grow, because it's going to create more of this stuff. Then you start firing this stuff out into its electromagnetic field, and that's sort of what goes on today. You know that our sun fires out 100 million tons of stuff from it every second?
Absolutely, and 100. We've been lucky some of the big stuff hasn't directly hit us.
Well, the question is it firing out big stuff? Or is it firing out simply ions and electrons? I don't think it's firing out any big stuff at all. Because all it has is hydrogen and helium, and those are just gases. So what it does is fires out hydrogen and helium, 100 million tons a second. Now, you multiply that over 5 billion years, you can build some planets with that. 100 million tons a second. Nobody sits and does the math. I don't know why. You sit and do the math on a calculator, you're going to end up with a lot of zeros. And the sun is firing them out. And still the sun seems to be growing. In fact, scientists will tell you that the sun has increased quite a bit since 3 billion years ago. And it's gotten a lot brighter.
That's another reason for global warming, huh?
Maybe. I think that what happens is you get a balance. You know, the planets move out as the sun grows. There's a certain balance to the universe. It makes sense. Now, that balance is probably likely, in my opinion, of course, it's only opinion, fellas, so don't anybody jump on me here. It's an electromagnetic field of the sun that seems to allow the planets to live on it. In other words, the planets are set a certain distance apart. It's called Bode's Law. Neil's Law says that's an electromagnetic field, and we sit on the lines of electromagnetic field because, well, let me see, we're made out of iron for the most part, and iron is attracted to the lines around a magnet. So if the sun has an electromagnetic field, the biggest in our solar system, logically it has lines, or else magnetism doesn't work the way they tell us. So if that's the case, then planets that have iron cores, or there's a lot of cores, a lot of iron in the planet, will be attracted to those lines and then set at a certain distance out from the sun. And as the sun grows, the lines move outward and everything is logical and makes sense, or else it's chaos, as most scientists seem to think it is. So the sun is firing out electrons it fires out helium atoms. Okay. When it does that, it strips the atoms of the electrons. It has two electrons, two protons, two neutrons, and when it fires them out, it strips the electrons off. So when we get that solar wind coming from the sun, it's essentially electrons and ions. Ions are what's left after you take off the electrons. take off the electrons, you got an ion, okay? And that's what the sun is firing out. Those ions are the core of a helium atom, same thing with the hydrogen atom. Now, since the cores are flying out and there's no electrons, one of the things you learn in science is that you can't make an atom get any bigger because the electron shell protects it, doesn't allow any more protons and neutrons in.
Right.
So if you strip those electrons off, then it's very sensible to believe that those ions can join one another and make bigger count atoms, might even make iron. And then finally, when the electrons start to gather around it, they stop that growth and stop that atom from becoming any bigger. So what you have is you have a sun that has simply hydrogen and helium. It might have other material in the core, but essentially the stuff it fires off is hydrogen and helium. It fires it off, strips off the electrons, the ions fly out, join other ions, become higher count atoms, electrons wrap around them again, and now you have the material from which you can make a solar system. In other words, to put it simply, Mama Sun makes its own solar system.
And it's happening, I think, throughout the universe. The same pattern. It's
exactly.
It's everywhere.
And it's a pattern of sensible growth. It's not magic. It suddenly disappeared. It's not all these meteorites were floating around. If you say that all these meteorites were floating around and gravity gathered them together, you have to explain where the meteorites came from. And if you say, well, they came from another sun that exploded, which is a rather curious idea, at some point you run out of suns to explode because as you go back in time, you have less and less material. So the logic is that you're making matter and then you're recomposing it, and then you make the stuff that you have. Now, I'm not saying this is true. I'm just saying it's another view, and one should be considered. Partially because the way science works is, in my opinion, but of course I think some scientists will agree, if you have a theory that tends to want to explain all this stuff, it has to explain everything that we know, and then it has to explain a whole bunch more things. That's what this theory does. It says, no, the universe didn't burst into existence. There was no Big Bang. What happened was you had nothing. You have pre-matter. We don't know what that is. You made hydrogen out of it. You gathered the hydrogen into suns. The suns, because they became suns, lit up, burned, created heat. That thermal heat caused the creation of neutrons. The neutrons created helium. The helium got blasted out into space, the electrons stripped off, the ions collected into higher count atoms, it creates the solar system. Now you have the solar system gathering around the sun.
But what a design, Neil, huh?
It's
what
an
incredible design.
You know, please, you guys, whoever's out there, don't write me letters and tell me, you know, like, I'm an idiot and all the rest of it. I agree I'm an idiot. I'm just a comic book artist, and I'm just looking at the pieces. I'm just looking at the pieces, and they make sense this way. And I can't, in all honesty, I can't find a hole in it. Now, what happens with all this is that if you do start with this kind of a theory, you basically say, if you think it's a complicated universe, if you think that there are all these other kinds of particles, why not we look at those particles that we do know and find out if whether or not these other particles are forms or energized forms or hidden forms of these same particles. In other words, why do we want to get involved in a lot of different things? For example, okay, science tells us that there's such a thing as gravity and there's also electromagnetic force, and we're trying to unify these concepts. So I think I sit back and I go, well, you know, I know that science and the universe made negative and positive electromagnetic force. It's a little hard for me to imagine that nature or whatever it is sat back and said, well, I got this negative force, electromagnetic, I got this positive force. I'm not busy today. Why don't I make another positive force and I'll call it gravity? But, and somebody will come along and tap them on the shoulder and go, well, wait a second, you know, every action takes an equal and opposite reaction. If you're going to create gravity, you have to create like an anti-gravity. No, I don't want to do that. I just want to create a gravity. To me, that doesn't make sense. I like the electromagnetic positive force and the electromagnetic negative force.
Yes.
I find it a little hard to believe that gravity as a new force was created out of for no reason. Why do we already have the positive and the negative force. Why are we getting involved in a new positive force? Is there some way to hook that gravity into electromagnetic force? Because if there is a way, it would make the universe make a lot more sense.
Neil, I'm going to bring in for just a few moments here someone who loves your work. He's our science advisor. He also heads up the enterprisemission.com, Richard C. Hoagland.
Hey,
and Richard has come up with, you know, his theories of Mars and Cydonia. Hey, Richard, a few minutes left. Come on in. Are you there? Well, where did he go?
I don't know.
Well, we'll get him back on and make sure we can take advantage of that as quickly as possible. He was there.
Okay.
Because I saw his name on our screen.
I'm sure.
He's the one who's come up with the theory of the face on Mars.
Ah. Well, you know, there are some interesting things about Mars. People keep trying to find water on Mars. I don't honestly think they're going to find any standing water on Mars. They might find what you call upgassing from the inside of the planet, which is exactly how we get water on Earth. Because it's got to come from somewhere, and I don't think it comes from my Aunt Nettie's house.
Let's try Richard again.
Sure.
There you are. You there, Richard?
I'm here now.
My incredible computer system. But go ahead, because I'm nipping into your questioning here.
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate Neil on being an exquisite expositor of a group of geologists who have not gotten a lot of mainstream press, a lot of scientific publicity, but who've been quietly working for years on exactly this idea.
Exactly.
Namely, that the Earth and other planets expand. And the one thing that Neil didn't say, which obviously is because he's so familiar with this, he kind of said it in his mind, but he didn't say it to you. The only way this works is if there is the creation of matter in planets, in stars.
Exactly.
Which in the HD model, the hyperdimensional model, is an exact prediction along with the energy that these planets and stars are emitting. It's coming from another dimension. It's the inverse of E equals MC squared, where you take energy from another dimension and convert it into matter in this dimension. And it explains the dark energy problem, why the universe is accelerating, apparently, away from someplace, although I agree that the Big Bang, per se, did not happen. Anyway, I just have to hand it to you, Neil. You have given an extraordinarily cogent explanation for all the folks that are not scientists of a very important idea. And it is obviously for the first time again on Coast, another first, George. And I just have to hand it to both you guys for giving us a terrifically entertaining and informative evening.
Well, thank you. How very nice.
Now I got a question.
Go ahead.
Neil, did you ever know Jack Kirby?
Yeah, sure.
did you know, this was what I published Monday on the Enterprise Mission website.
To tell everybody that Jack Kirby is probably the king of comic
books. Oh, yeah, you got to tell who Jack Kirby
because
is.
You left something out there. Jack Kirby is probably, besides Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the greatest comic book artist that ever lived.
20-some thousand pages, I believe.
Oh, my God.
Exactly.
Incredible guy. He also was a multidimensional guy, and he created most of the characters that are made into these movies, like the Hulk and Spider-Man and, you know, the Fantastic Four. And, I mean, he had
an incredible... Wouldn't it be nice if his family got some of the royalties?
Wouldn't it be wonderful?
Oh,
not
again.
Just putting out that message.
Here is my question, and I'll get off the air, and you can answer it after the break because you're going to need a little time to answer this.
Sure.
At the Enterprise Mission website, we have a new post. Was done up Monday for the Mars mission going to basically go into orbit, the proper orbit in October, called MRO. And it's called Forbidden Planet, ... Mars. And it's going to come in several parts. In part one, George, if you have the time to scan down, you'll notice that I included a cover of a comic from 1958.
I'm going to have to let you ask him the question when we come back, Richard. Okay, and when we last left you, our science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland from the enterprisemission.com, was about to ask Neil a question before the clock got us. So, Richard, you're back and you're on with Neil, and I will give you the first shot this hour. Go ahead.
How are you, Richard?
Don't tell me we've lost him again. Richard? Okay, well, we'll get back to him in just a moment. So anyways, we're going to take your phone calls this hour. Comic book questions, if you want, but also geared to what we're talking about back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back. Richard, somebody doesn't want you to ask your question.
You know, this is really interesting. We have to get you out of the cave and back to civilization.
Man, go ahead.
Anyway,
try it again.
Anyway, Neil, Jack Kirby, he was a huge figure in your industry. He created most of the amazing characters that everybody enjoys today that are made into movies, including, I think, the X-Men. Didn't he do X-Men?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
I had a little something to do with that along the way.
I heard about that. Anyway, in 1958, he created a comic series, I think it ran 3 or 4 issues, called Race to the Moon, or Race for the Moon. And in issue number 2, there was an incredible story with a cover that I put up on Enterprise last week, George, depicting the face on Mars in 1958, almost 20 years before the rest of the world and NASA would find out about this thing. How the hell did Kirby know?
Well, you can't trust those comic book guys.
I know.
They must have
brains.
They're
slippery.
They're slippery guys. They just... You know, the thing about Jack Kirby is that he is well, we don't want to say genius because nobody likes to talk about a comic book guy having genius, but
why not?
His foresightedness in so many areas, you cannot do the kind of work that somebody like Jack Kirby could do without him having wellsprings of things that other people don't see and aren't aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack is one of those people. He sees things that other people don't see.
Did he have sources?
He of course had sources.
Well, when I don't mean inspirational. I'm talking about like there's
specific,
one biography I see where he was actually a spy in the Army in World War II, which means he would have been involved with Wild Bill Donovan's OSS. He spoke fluent German. We know there's a German connection to this tale.
I think there's a lot of unreleased stuff involving Jack Kirby in his life. But a lot of those are very much like other people, suspicions, conclusions that he came to on a private basis. That knowing the way the world is, you really can't look. It's stupid for me to be saying some of the things that I'm saying because people say, you know, Neil's wacky. But you can put it into your work. So what happens is that when you do make these observations and when you have certain life experiences in something like this. Then what you do is, rather than try to, you know, put yourself out to have your to have somebody belt you in the head, essentially is you put it into your work. So artists hide stuff in their work, things that they know, things they have observed, and conclusions they may have come to, without, you know, presenting it as a serious thing. So if you look at Jack Kirby's work, you're going to see an awful lot of things unexpectedly done. And did he or didn't he? Jack never talked to me about it. Is it possible? Certainly. Certainly.
Well, I wanted to ask you, and I'm glad I got the chance. And, George, you had a hell of a guest tonight.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for being part of the program. EnterpriseMission.com, by the way.
Thank you, Richard.
He adds a nice flavor and touch to the program.
You know, George, let me just say that this is my discussion with you has been a kind of a one-sided discussion. And, of course, there are opposing views. I mean, it's not as though the world is sitting around waiting for Neil Adams to have his say. There are views that say why all these things have happened, that they come down to a theory called subduction theory. Subduction theory basically says that the oceanic crust dives under the continental crust, or nowadays they're saying more dives under the oceanic crust, and goes back into the anastosphere, or what they used to call the magma, but now they don't call it the magma anymore, and essentially melts back into the crust of the Earth. This is a very long discussion, and they have a point of view which is the prevailing point of view, and it's the point of view you'll hear. If you take calls, some people will say these things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree. And they will say, well, we have scientific proof, and we have X-rays of the under the crust, and we have measurements of the Earth, and you know, I think those are good proofs, and I think that's the prevailing thinking. And since you really don't have to worry about a comic book artist having these ideas, those folks ought to just go on and keep saying the things that they do. And I think that what I ought to do is just present this point of view and say, why don't we just continue this investigation from this point of view?
That's right.
Why don't we take tectonic measurements in the Pacific? Why don't we actually measure the circumference of the Earth completely in every direction and see if there is any change? I know that the people who will come on will say, oh, we've already done that. We know this. We have GPS and we have all these things. You know, it's funny how things change. In time, People discover new things. People reveal information that wasn't revealed before, and then we discover new things. All I'm saying is there's an awful lot of evidence since William Carey that the Earth is growing and that all these things are growing. I've put a lot of it into my videos. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm simply saying, guys, this is what I've gathered, and it sure looks odd to me.
Well, you have a good eye about it, and that's what's important. You know, you look at it from the perspective of a graphic artist, a creator, someone who understands the look of geography, and it all makes sense. When I looked at the Earth specifically, computer model, several hours before we were on the air tonight, and just saw the way you had it mesh in and pull out and go back in again, I mean, it was an incredible puzzle.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you something about that puzzle. You know, scientists will tell you that India, the creation of India, you may have heard this story. What it was is India was on the side of Africa, and somehow it broke off. It rode up the Indian Ocean and crashed into Asia and created the Himalayas. And that's why you have the Himalayas, that India crashed into Asia very, very slowly, of course, and caused the Himalayas to happen. This is explained this way because they know that the west coast of India clearly matches tectonically the east coast of Africa, mm-hmm. but down lower. And that's why they say this. Now, I would say this. If you look at my map of the growing Earth, what you'll see is as the Earth was smaller, India was attached both to Africa and to Asia at the same time on a smaller Earth, and it broke off of Africa and remained attached to Asia. Then a scientist will logically say, yes, but it crashed into Asia, and it made those mountains. To which I would say, well, fellas, let's go to physics. In physics, we have this thing that goes something like every force is matched by an equal and opposite force going the other way. If those mountains in Asia were created by India crashing into it, then the same force should have made all of India totally mountainous.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot...
Right.
Take physics and throw it out the window. So you can say this geologically, and you can even believe it. But according to physics, it doesn't work that way. You have to have an equal and opposite force. So one of the reasons I've studied all these other sciences, and I don't mean as a specialist. I mean, I don't know, you know, all the higher math, and I don't know the Latin, and I don't know the six-syllable words, and I don't memorize them all. But I study physics from the point of view of practical physics, how it works. And you can't, there's certain things that they say in geology and how the Earth works that doesn't match the physics. And what we need, in my opinion, is a discussion of all sciences. I think you have to give as much validity to this science as you give to this science.
Yeah.
If you say a Tyrannosaurus cannot exist and be a predator at 10 tons, he can only be a scavenger. And there's two scientists that go on the Discovery Channel and debate that back and forth. You have to say, as an alternate theory, what if gravity were less? Couldn't he then be a predator and weigh one quarter of what he presumably weighs,
mm-hmm.
and his head not snap off when he takes a corner?
Exactly.
There's so many logical explanations for the way things are within this theory. That then you have to balance it against what we know. I don't mind arguing and debating with folks, but people are not looking at Samuel Carey's ideas, which I finally learned who this guy was, and he's brilliant. They have to take Samuel Carey's ideas and mix it in with all of the rest of sciences and look at it from that point of view. And when you do that, it does, to me, look like a different picture.
Let's
and there
go
seem
to, the
to be more and more people who feel that way.
We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line, as promised. You're on Coast to Coast with Neil Adams. Hi there.
Hello.
Good. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I have a comment or question, I guess, for Neil.
All right.
Sure.
Back in the early 80s, I read a book by Joseph Dillo, who wrote The Waters Above, Earth's Pre-Flood Vapor Canopy, and was quite technical and beyond my expertise.
And probably beyond mine.
Yeah. But then a couple months later, I happened to see on Nova a special about the flood. And their graphics that they showed are very similar to what you have, although they showed that a huge meteorite struck where what is now the Gulf of Mexico,
yeah,
and caused the Earth to crack like an eggshell, which created the Atlantic and Pacific rifts. And
oh, I think that's an interesting theory.
Okay. And at the same time, they claim that there was water below the continental shelves, caverns anywhere from 10 to 15 miles in depth.
Again, another interesting theory.
And when the Earth cracked, they claim, or this book claims, and even on the NOVA show, they claim that the spray or the force of the continents going down caused the water below the plates to go into the atmosphere about 100 miles and dissolve this canopy, which caused this 40 days of rain and whatnot. And even in the Bible says that the fountains of the deep were opened, and the, if I remember right, something like that, and that the gates of heaven were opened.
Hmm.
All this water coming down then would basically fill in what was very much like your solid continents,
yeah,
that you show. And
well,
create
let me give you another theory.
Okay. Okay?
Another theory. It's perhaps a little less dramatic. Most of, in the times of the Bible, most of the land that was populated by Western man that we know of was in the lower Mesopotamia by the Tigris and Euphrates River. Most of the civilizations that were there that began to write, the Sumerians and the other folks, lived in that area. Okay? 10 million years ago, we were coming out of the last ice age, which meant that the sea levels were quite a bit lower, very much lower.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as time went by, the ice receded, and we got higher and higher oceans. It's reasonable to think that the Persian Gulf, which is an area right about the area that we're talking about, was a floodplain, and people lived there and perhaps created civilizations there. If some of the melt took place, and if there was a tremendous storm, it could have breached the tip of the Persian Gulf, and the whole of the Persian Gulf, or at least a lot of it, could have been flooded. Any civilizations, any cities, any people that were there could have been completely flooded out in a flood that could have lasted 40 days and 40 nights. And any survivors that got into boats and were able to survive would have written legends of that tremendous flood that filled the Persian Gulf, and it would have been disseminated to the civilizations that were round about the Persian Gulf. Now, you'd have to put together the Persian Gulf, the tip of the Persian Gulf, what it looks like, how that looks like geologically, where civilization is, and the melting of the last ice age to cause that to happen. If you put all those pieces together, you could make a very good argument for saying that that civilization, which was the Sumerian civilization, which is the civilization that spread out into the various Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Babylonian civilizations, was caused by that event. It's a very reasonable explanation. I don't think that 15 miles of water underneath the continents is a reasonable explanation. It's an interesting explanation, and for all I know, could be true. But my mama told me, you know, you got to go by percentages. If you're walking down the street with me at night and you're my friend, and some guy is coming at us, and he's got a club in his hand, and I tell you, I got an 85% chance of taking that club away from that guy, and you know me, you probably believe that. If I tell you there's a chance that I can shift that guy off into another dimension, you'll probably hightail it out of there as fast as you can. I pretty much go by percentages. You know, I like these theories, and I think they're good. And after all, I'm a comic book artist and writer. I write about this stuff all the time. But there just has to be a reasonable amount of evidence that indicates this for me to say it. Are there rifts under the oceans? Yes, there are. Do they go through all the oceans of all the Earth and spread constantly? Yes. How do I know? Well, because they have television pictures on Discovery, and they show them to me all the time, and the facts are in. There's rifting and spreading under the oceans, all around the oceans on the Earth. Is there subduction? Is there a giant ocean of water under the Earth? Gosh, I don't think so, because it's solid rock under there, and they have seismic machines that are able to measure that, and they know that it's not liquid under there. Not because I say so. You know, you just have... I'll doubt things that are theory, But when things are fact, I really have to accept them.
Do you think there's any cracks on the sides of the continents, Neil, where rather than the landmass going straight down, that maybe it goes horizontally for a long period of time underneath comes out again?
I'm a country boy. You know, I pick up slate and pieces of rock, and I see how it acts. You know, you take a piece of slate and you wrap it, and you see it slide off one layer off the other, and I see that rock acts a certain way. Different kinds of rocks act a certain way. I think it's, for example, if you look at the Saudi Arabia, the bottom tip of Saudi Arabia, it's very clear that the bottom tip of Saudi Arabia actually slid off of the top of Africa in the upper right-hand corner. You can see it in these tectonic maps.
It's like a glove. Yeah.
So these kinds of activities do happen, and you have to study each area, and you have to make these deductions. And that's, of course, why we have geologists in the world. They can see this stuff, and they can write it up in books. And I read those same books that everybody else does, and what you're talking about certainly makes a lot of sense. Does it cause things? Does it cause the oceans to open? No, I don't think so. I think that what it does is it shows us what can happen if certain plates slide off of other plates. Yes. And again, it's all together in all these sciences. You just can't study one thing and figure you're going to get the answers. And I think part of that is why science is a little bit off these days. If I talk to a physicist and I say, can matter be created? He'll say no. If I talk to a geologist and I say, can matter be created? He'll say, explain your terms. And I'll say, what do you mean? He says, well, rocks can grow. I don't know if matter can be created, but I know rocks can grow. And I go to a physicist and I say, can rocks grow? He'll say, no, rocks can't grow. You have to have the same language. Now, I'm saying it in regular English, but if these two guys were talking in their language, you wouldn't even understand what they said, because they'd use all these big words that made no sense to you, and two words into the sentence, you wouldn't understand what they were saying. I think we have to have a common science, and I think we have to have a common language. I call it regular talk. That's a technical term for it. Regular talk. Let's just talk regular talk. Because, you know, I don't really believe that there are geniuses in the world. I really think that there are just regular folks, and they can talk regular talk, and, you know, if you can explain it to me simply, I can understand it.
Now, we'll be back with the final phone calls. Those of you on hold, we'll get to you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let's go right to the phones with our guest, Neil Adams, East of the Rockies. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Well, good morning, George and Sir Adams. I say sir because you might be knighted at some point. I just want to make sure it's covered. Cameron here from York, Ontario, Canada. And before I have you respond, Sir Adams, to whether or not Enceladus is spewing forth liquid nitrogen that would act like water because of the coldness of that planet, let me ask you something that I believe many were wanting to ask at the beginning of the show. Who would Adams think would be the best Batman? Who was the best Batman? Is there someone that wasn't casted that should have been casted? And before you respond to that, let me say, I believe, for my money, that Ray Liotta would be the best and should have been casted long before anyone else was considered. It's like not having Sean Connery, having seen all the films except his, and that to me was unfortunate. But the Robin I felt would be Eminem, Keanu Reeves, or even Rob Lowe, maybe Andrea Parker thrown in for Catwoman. But I'd also like to know whether or not the Green Hornet is coming down the pipe at some point. But surely this situation of Enceladus is very perplexing. It's a very cold planet. And why should we believe that it's warm water? Why isn't it compressed gas?
You know, I don't really know. And obviously it must be compressed gas that then condenses into water. It's not going to come out logically as water. At some point it's going to be gas and it's going to come out as water because it's cold. But in all honesty, I don't know that that's the question. The question to me is what's filling that space once the water leaves? I mean, I understand that people have a lot of thoughts about this, and I think it's very interesting to study the science. But the practical question is, if you got a squeeze bottle and you're squeezing stuff out of it, isn't it empty after you squeeze it?
Right.
Isn't there a big hole in there? Where's it coming from? I mean, if you place two questions in front of me and you say, let's talk about what it's made out of and what it's composed of, or let's try to explain how it's possible that Enceladus seemed to be growing and still spraying stuff from its inside out. what's making that? That, to me, is the question. And I agree with you that the other question is interesting,
The thermal suggestion of having warm water is quite perplexing because of the coldness.
They actually have picked up water droplets, you know, and they have analyzed them. According to one of the news reports that I read, you never know with those news reports, but that seemed to be, hydrogen and oxygen. But
all right, I'll wait for your response on the Batman notion. You have a good night, Dylan.
Okay, thanks, Cameron. Go ahead, Neil.
You know, it's funny. If the Batman movie was made years ago, you know, there's this fella, Ted Danson, that was on Cheers.
Yeah.
He's 6'3", square jawed. You know, you take him as a comedian. But boy, when he was back in the day, he just looked great. Take that hair, put it down, put it under the helmet. He would have made a great Batman visually. He actually was a good actor, all in all. Still is, you know, but I think he missed his calling. I think he should have been Batman.
What did you think of Michael Keaton?
You know, Michael Keaton is a human being. I don't want to criticize him, you know, but it's not Batman.
It's not Batman.
Well, it's Batman. Look, I've had a fair amount to do with Batman. What is that? Batman, 6'2",
yep.
Square shoulders, Olympic athlete, Sherlock Holmesian brain, good-looking, women fall all over him. I've met guys like that. I don't think that happened.
George Clooney.
A little better if he was two inches taller and he was serious about the role. I think it would have been terrific. I think he was reasonably serious. You know, I think he did his job, and I personally like George Clooney. I think he, of the Batman, was the best Batman, but I just think the material he had kind of held it back a little bit. I think you need an unknown. You don't want to say George Clooney is Batman. You want to go, this is Batman.
This
like the new
Batman.
Superman movie,
exactly.
Got an unknown.
That's true.
Know?
Good point.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. Did you actually say that you needed neutrons to make helium?
No.
I'm pretty sure you said that, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Do you know what deuterium is?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's a form of helium, right?
No, it's a form of hydrogen.
Hydrogen, okay.
He admitted he's a comic book writer.
Well, yeah, but...
Tell me your point.
My point is, you put a neutron into a helium atom, one neutron, it's called deuterium.
Okay.
You put two neutrons in, it's called tritium. They're called isotopes.
Okay.
And the difference between isotopes is the number of neutrons. You don't make helium by adding neutrons. You make helium by adding a proton.
Yeah, but you add a proton, but you need neutrons as well.
Yes, because the basic stable isotope of helium has two neutrons. But the thing that makes it different chemically, that makes it hydrogen one hand, helium the other, is that one has one proton and the other one has two.
But it also has two neutrons. In other words, hydrogen is the only atom that has no neutron. The helium atom has two.
Well, that's not true. I just explained what deuterium and tritium are. Your basic proton with one electron is hydrogen. Now, you can add neutrons to that, and you get different isotopes, but it's still hydrogen. My point is just that you're starting with very simple things like that and making basic misconceptions and misperceptions and then building this entire structure. I mean, I could go on. For example, the lunar mare, the reason there's none on the far side of the moon, well, that's not true. 2.5% of the surface of the far side is covered with mare, as opposed to 31% on the front. 12 times
okay.
as much. 12 times as
you're
much
talking
on the
about
front.
That. You're talking about that one on the right-hand side, right?
Well, the point is that there are mare on the far side, and the reason that there are fewer is because of the far side of the moon, the crust is 24 miles thicker than on the near side. And the reason that the moon faces the Earth one side is because of what's called tidal locking, which is because the moon is so large compared to the size of the Earth, much larger than any other satellite in the solar system compared to its planet.
Are you a geologist?
No, I know everything. I'm one of those people who, as you like to say, has studied a lot of everything. I'm called a polymath. I'm a science fiction writer. I go by Petronius because I don't care to get my real name. But the simple fact is, do you know who Sir Fred Hoyle is?
At the moment, I'm drawing a blank.
My goodness.
But you have such a good memory, you can tell me.
You put forth a theory that you said the universe doesn't change, that there's no Big Bang. I'm surprised you and your reading haven't come across what's called the steady state theory, which was put forth by
Let me just say this. I'm not a memorizer. In all honesty, the likelihood is that I read it because, of course, I do read stuff, but
well,
I don't memorize.
You should have. This is like extremely famous because there was
well,
a huge
that makes me that makes me just a humble, you know,
people.
Artist.
Well, Mr. Science Writer, have you looked at his animation?
No, I'm not a science writer. I'm a science fiction writer.
Okay, well, but just why don't you tell us rather than
I'll tell you. Steady state theory says that the universe has been the same in time and space as far back as we can go, that it hasn't changed and that it's been a creation of energy.
Well, that's what we were looking for tonight, Neil,
absolutely.
The other side.
Yeah, there we go.
Absolutely, listen, and this is a valid theory. It's based on a philosophical problem with the Big Bang theory. And there are things that the steady state explains and the Big Bang explains.
Let me just say this. It's all out there. Talking about is all out there. You can pretty much, you can Google it, and you can get pages and pages and pages on this stuff. And I think that's terrific, you know.
See,
I think,
you asked for the other side, Neil, and you got it.
And there you go. There you go.
The first time caller line.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's called the steady state theory. That's pretty much the way we think of it. It's all the universe always existed, always will exist, and that's the way it is. Didn't grow, didn't appear, didn't. And that's probably right. You know, the logic is that that's how. But it doesn't sit well with me. I don't know why. It just seems to me that sort of like everything else, you know, that it appeared and it started, a process started, and it continued and continued until we have the universe we have today, and it's probably still going on. And that's why it seems as though the universe is accelerating outward. It's really just growing, according to this theory.
I wonder if you two would get along if you were the illustrator of his science fiction projects.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, first-time caller line, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Yes, hello, Neil?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Neil, it's fantastic. You've got me so excited. I've been a broke out into a sweat. I'm not going to sleep all night. I have been 50 years on a book about the cosmos.
Uh-huh.
And we're parallel thinkers.
Well, there you go.
And the only thing is I've put a little more in the beginning of the concept and the end. I have about a 200-page manuscript that's both text and graphics.
You know, I think there are a lot of people that are a little dissatisfied with the way things have been going. And that when you the more we get out into space, for example, and the more of the moons that we see, the more rifts and cracks that we see on those surfaces, the more spreading that seems to, sure. to take place. If you look at Enceladus, if you look at all these moons, if you look at the ones that I have on my site, I'm just using them as examples. There seems to be the same kind of rifting and spreading that goes on Earth and goes on Mars, goes
I'm totally excited. I think this is the theory that's going to come into being very soon, and I think you're about to start it.
Well, but I'm going to get kicked around a lot by fellows like that last fellow an awful
lot.
Well,
he's just a grouch, that's all. anyway, I'd like to be able to get in contact with you.
Well, I certainly have a website.
Okay.
It's neiladams.com. It's the hardest website in the world to remember.
They can email you through that website?
Yeah, but, you know, if you got to remember that after this show, an awful lot of emails are going to come in. So
yes, it's going
to take a little bit easy on me.
You got that right. Back to the phones. Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Yes, I was going to say, I know of an eerie, or not eerie, but a rather good parallel for what your guest is saying.
All right, what is that?
Well, if you look at a river and you watch the solid particles come out of solution, it's just exactly like what your guest is saying.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Do you know what I'm saying there?
I think I do.
I don't. Explain it to me.
Okay,
go ahead.
Well,
can you explain that?
Okay, like the lime that builds up on your faucet at home.
Right.
Those are particles that are invisible in solution.
Yes.
And they shake out, basically.
I see.
So basically what he's saying is that the ether or whatever it is must be some kind of fluid that solid particles shake out of when they're hit with this cosmic ray.
Well, okay, you know, that's a very good analogy. I don't know that I would, if I would put it exactly that way, but if the universe is filled with this stuff that we can't see, and something happens from an impact of a cosmic ray, what we call a cosmic ray, but it's obviously a particle, and we get as a result matter, then obviously you cannot say that there's nothing there if you hit something and you get two pieces of matter. I mean, you can go to a hospital and they use positron emission tomography, which is exactly the same process. And what happens is, you know, they're breaking, in effect, using radiation to create particles that go into your body, and the positrons destroy electrons. They make a little burst of energy, and they measure what's going on in your body by doing this. They're using this technology. So essentially, you're making matter out of it, some Einstein would say, out of energy. But it didn't exist there before. And now you do something with it, and it exists. So one cannot say that you can't make matter. You may qualify it, and you may have all these things to say about it, but essentially matter is being made. So there is a process, whether or not you can make protons out of positrons. Of course, people argue with me until somebody does it one day, and everybody will go, well, I guess you can. But yes, you're right. For example, how do you make crystals in a cave? Well, you have minerals that are dissolved in water, and they go down and they evaporate or whatever it is, and they collect in crystals, and you get crystals. It looks solid. It's a rock, you know, but it was dissolved originally. How do you get salt, for example? You have two elements that are gas, and they combine and they become salt, something, a rock that you can eat. And these are not mysteries. These are everyday things. We don't discuss them in a forum where we can go, gee, if this is true, and then this is true, then over here, this might be true. Isn't that part of a new way of looking at it, and why don't we do that? I'd like to see that done, and what you're saying is true.
One or two more callers, that'll be it. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I got a theory for you.
All right.
Okay. Basically, you talked about a little bit about it, but back when the flood was, would it be possible the earth was smaller and all that water on there forced the land apart?
It wouldn't have been that much smaller, but it might have broken the Persian Gulf open after the last ice age. I can see that. But beyond that, remember, this happens really, really slowly. Very, very slowly. We're talking about hundreds of millions of years.
If you were watching it with the naked eye unfold, Neil, would you see the landmass moving?
Well,
is that how slow it would move, where you won't even see it move?
You wouldn't see it move. I mean, you'd see it during an earthquake, and you'd see land. You walk up on an area of an earthquake, and you see the land split open, okay? And it's cracked open. And, of course, scientists will come and explain to you how it happens. But you're a regular human being, and you look at that crack in the land, and you go, where did that stuff go?
You know, it's like living with somebody for 20 years. Every day you look at them, and every day to you, they look the same. Except when you look at a picture from year one and year 20,
yeah,
it's a tremendous difference.
Exactly.
Same
and that's
time.
The way, you know, that's the way tectonics works. I mean, if you stand on the edge of the United States and you look out over the Atlantic, we know for a fact that Europe and Africa were connected to the North American and South American continent, for a fact. And you look out over the ocean and you go, impossible. That could not have happened. But in fact, it happened.
It is a glove.
You know, it's amazing.
Last caller. No, finish your and.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, one of the things that people forget about is that way back in the ages of the dinosaurs, two-thirds of the upper continental plate that we live on was covered with water. They were called shallow seas. In the middle of America, there were shallow seas, and dinosaurs and sharks and all those things swam in there, covered two-thirds. Where did that stuff go? It had to drain off into some lower place, or otherwise the sea level should be, you know, half a mile higher than it is now.
There's
things that if you start putting them together, they lead down a path.
When is your novel complete?
Well, my novel is complete now. I'm really editing it. I'm not doing it commercially. I'm doing it to try to, you know, hit the truth, and that'll
sure
be out fairly soon. But
how about the 2-hour video?
That'll go with it. It'll be tucked in it.
All right, good for you. You know what? This is definitely a discovery television show, Neil.
I think so. It'd be really interesting to see, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. So what else is on your plate in the world of comic books in 30 seconds?
Well, I'm doing a six-parter for DC Comics. I'm not supposed to tell who it's about, but it's a guy with a very long cape, and I've done him before. And I can't, I don't want, they want to do it, you know, they want to do this publicity thing on him, so I'm a little reluctant to say who it is, but
understand.
You can sort of guess.
I understand. Well, look, you've been a great guest tonight, the enlightening theory.
Thank
and,
you,
and I believe a lot of it, I got to tell you.
I don't, you know, I'm not so interested in people believing it. I'm interested in people at least giving it a chance and investigating it. Folks are really good about it, you know, they're very flexible. Scientists are, I wish they were a little more flexible, and they would give it a shot, because I think there's a geologist somewhere who's sitting with a whole bunch of figures saying, you know, I have figures that show the Earth grows.
Let's stay in touch, Neil.
Okay.
Be good.
George.
Neil Adams.
Bye.
What a great guy. I'm Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Rob Ismail, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. They all contribute and put together Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.